Now, in terms of this, it was therefore the Soviets, not the Germans, who were exterminating the Jews like that? Or?
Well, no, what the Soviets did was they created the propaganda. The Soviets liberated all of the camps in Eastern Europe. The Americans and the British liberated camps in the West. So, for example, the Soviets liberated Auschwitz, and they liberated Majdanek. They liberated the barren ground where camps like Treblinka and Sobibor once stood. The Americans and the British liberated camps like Dachau, Mauthausen, Bergen-Belsen, that are all in Germany. None of these camps had gas chambers, but the Eastern Allies and the Western Allies all wanted them to. Because one of the things to remember about World War II that makes World War II such a fascinating war is that World War II was a war with an ex post facto reason for being. When World War II started, it began with the banner of keeping Poland independent. Germany invades Poland. The French and the British declare war on Germany. And Germany declares war on them back and kind of beats the hell out of them, chases the British back to the sea. So the whole war began under the banner of we need to keep Poland free and independent. Well, at the end of the war, the Western Allies pretty much handed Poland to Stalin. Well, that's a fine mess right there. 60, 70 million people are dead. Some of the greatest cities in the world burned to the ground. And it was all supposed to be in order to keep Poland free. And now we're handing Poland over to Stalin. If people had really thought about that and meditated on that for a few moments, it would have been mind-breaking for so many people, because so many people around the world lost loved ones in World War II. So when you tell people the whole reason for the war is now being completely betrayed because we went to war to keep Poland from being a Nazi satellite, and now we're giving Poland to Stalin to be a Soviet satellite. So what was necessary in 1945 was a new reason for the war to have happened. And when the Allies came upon the camps and saw many ill, very sick, dying people in camps like Bergen-Belsen, people dying of typhus and dysentery and cholera, the Allies decided, well, now this is going to be the reason for the war. Here's why we fought. Look at these terrible, sick, horribly mutilated, dying people being gassed and burned. This is why this is why we had to fight. Except that even among the most ardent of the Orthodox Holocaust scholars, no one claims the Holocaust began until the end of 1941, maybe slightly in the summer of 41, and then in earnest by the end. The war started in 39, 2 years earlier. The Holocaust is not the reason for the war. But if you ask the average kid, teenager, or even 30-year-old or 40-year-old these days, you say, why did we have to fight World War II? And they'll say, well, because they were Holocausting the Jews. They were Holocausting people. Something that was not going on when the war began has now become the reason for the war. And that's why I say it was an ex post facto reason for being. It was necessary at the end of the war. The Soviets had to come up with a reason for the war beyond Poland, because they were about to quite literally annex Poland. And the Western Allies had to come up with a reason for the war beyond Poland, because we were handing Poland to Stalin. So those horrible scenes of concentration camp inmates in 45, sick, skeletal. These people were not to blame for their condition, and it's terrible footage. But the Allies made those scenes the reason for the war, and everyone in the United States, my parents who were preteens at the time, they'd go to the movies and they would see these newsreels where the narrator would very breathlessly say, "This is why we went to war. Look at these poor people who are dying in skeletal because they've been gassed. They've been gassed and they were about to be burned, but our allies, our troops got there and saved them, and that's why we fought." So that's what makes World War II very interesting, is how there was there was one reason going in and then a separate reason coming out.
Well, it's kind of like, in military terms, you call it targets of opportunity. Like, if it just appears before, yeah, let's attack then. Kind of like, this is an excuse of opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. When the, for example, would take the Bergen-Belsen camp. Bergen-Belsen was a camp that was liberated by the British in 45. Now, Bergen-Belsen, during the war, Bergen-Belsen was not a bad place to be. And I want to explain that because I don't want that to be taken out of context. During the war, Bergen-Belsen served as what was called a hostage camp. When the Germans would capture someone of importance to the other side, they would send them to Bergen-Belsen for safekeeping, in order to try to barter them off for someone of importance to the German side. To give a specific example, when Stalin's son, Yakov Yugoshvili, when Stalin's son was captured by the Germans, Stalin's son was taken to Bergen-Belsen because Stalin's son was an important hostage who was to be kept healthy and fed in hopes of bartering him off for someone of importance to the Nazi leaders. So during the war, if you were at Bergen-Belsen, the camp, you would be assured that you'd be fed and you'd be cleaned, and that you wouldn't be bombed by the Allies, because the Allies weren't about to bomb the camp where their loved ones might be held. So during the war, Bergen-Belsen was a very underpopulated camp where if you were sent there, you pretty much had a good chance of living. But at the very end of the war, the last couple of months of the war, when the Germans were trying to move their slave labor force into their interior, they were moving their slave laborers away from the east and away from the Eastern Front and into the interior of Germany. Here was Bergen-Belsen, a camp that was always underpopulated, which meant it had a lot of room, had a great deal of room. So they begin cramming their slave labor force into Bergen-Belsen, a camp that was maybe built to house 8,000 at most, was now having 80 or 90,000.
It sounds like they turned Bergen-Belsen into a Bergen-Schmergen.
Well, yeah, I think that's one way to put it, certainly. And it, needless to say, of course, it was a terrible tragedy for the people forced in there. But then another interesting thing happened. Once it was clear that the British were coming in close to Bergen-Belsen, the SS guards fled because the SS had done something rather silly from a point of view of not wanting to get killed if you lose a war. The SS had tattoos identifying them as SS, meaning that if the British or the Soviets or the Americans caught you and saw your tattoo, you were probably just going to get shot right there. So the SS who were guarding Bergen-Belsen didn't want to stick around and get shot by the British. So when the British entered Bergen-Belsen, the inmates had been running it for a couple of weeks. because the SS had fled and the inmates were kind of running it. People would always ask me, well, why didn't the inmates just flee? Once the SS fled, why did the inmates stay there in the camp? And the answer to that is, well, number one, there really wasn't anywhere for them to run because all of Germany had been bombed back to the Stone Age. So as bad as Bergen-Belsen was, it wasn't like there was some paradise outside the gates. But more
it was like there a choice between a bombed out city with nothing, with nowhere to sleep, or a internment camp that still has a roof at least.
Yeah, exactly. And also, not only still has a roof, but whereas the Allies were bombing the cities, they were not bombing the camps. So if you were in Bergen-Belsen, at least you knew that you're not about to get blown up by a bomb. And it seemed like a better deal than trying to make your way in the cities that were getting bombed to flatland. So when the British entered Bergen-Belsen, they found the inmates pretty much running the show. The disease was terrible because all over Germany, everything that contributes to hygiene had been bombed. The fresh water lines, the railways, the sewers had been blown up. All of Germany was reduced to the worst possible conditions, and that was true in the camps as well as outside the camps. But the inmates stayed in the camps because they knew as long as they stayed in the camps, as long as the people in Bergen-Belsen stayed in Bergen-Belsen, they knew that once the Red Cross got there with the British Army, they would get relief. They would get care packages and food and the ability to emigrate, to sign up, to go to the West. It was a better deal than if they just tried to blend in among the German cities, because German citizens, especially in 1945 during the Morgenthau Plan, when the Truman administration at the time was looking to be as vengeful and cruel as possible to the German citizenry, it was a better deal to stay in the camp and be seen as a prisoner of conscience than it was to be seen as a German citizen. So all of these things led to the inmates of Bergen-Belsen staying there. That is not to excuse the slave labor mentality of the Nazi state. Of course, the British had that mentality, and the Americans and all of the major powers, of course, the Japanese especially, they all had that mentality. None of it is excusable, but as a historian, the whole idea is you just try to explain what happened. And when the British went into Bergen-Belsen and saw these sick people, that became, all of a sudden, the reason for the war. And you have Trevor Howard, brilliant, famous British actor, and you have Alfred Hitchcock, both of them doing documentaries in 1945. And here we have the gas chambers at Bergen-Belsen where millions of people were snuffed out. And it's just complete phoniness. It's just war propaganda. There's nothing behind it. And on the American side, the same thing. We did the same thing at the Dachau camp, which had never been an extermination camp, but we hired American voice actors. Here we are at Dachau, where millions of people are gassed, and here's a gas chamber. It was pure propaganda for the masses at that time.
I mean, that would be almost as much just BS as saying the reason they call it Dachau is because the doorways were a little bit lower, so you had to duck out.
Yeah. I never thought of that, but thank you. That's actually a very interesting way to look at it, because, yeah, the American Army, the U.S. Army, took a very standard shower room, turned it into a gas chamber, because a whole bunch of United States Congress people were going to come and tour it. And you can see those photographs online of senators, congressmen.
The soldiers wanted to gas all of those people, I wouldn't be, opposed to it, but you know.
yes, it's a shame that the room didn't actually work as a gas chamber, because, yeah, I would probably say that for my congress people and senators, yes, there would be no great loss. But it would for the people back at home, for the people in New York and London and the various allied states, it was jarring to see this propaganda and to be told that these were gas chambers and that this was a planned program of extermination. Now, normally, within a couple of decades, this propaganda could be reversed. I mean, that there was Civil War, American Civil War propaganda. There's World War I propaganda. And typically, within a few decades, cooler heads prevailed. But once the propaganda was initiated by the Allies, by the Soviets and the Western Allies, then the Jewish constituency took that ball and ran with it. And it became more important. One of the things that your listeners might want to know, the term Holocaust only became popularized in the 1970s, some 30 years later. No one used the term Holocaust. You can look at the Nuremberg transcripts. You can look at every transcript from the Nuremberg trial, the main Nuremberg trial, and then the minor trials, the smaller ones that happened years afterwards.
Did they used to call it solid cost and then they called it Holocaust when it realized it didn't hold water?
I'm just now getting used to your Kiwi humor right now, and I'm appreciating it very, very much.
Oh, no, this is just Vinny humor. The rest of the country doesn't think I'm funny, Brad.
Well, I do. I certainly think you're very funny, and I, as I said, I'm just now getting to appreciate the humor. And this is a kind of inversion of how things normally go. Normally, the propaganda is hot and heavy during the war, and then a couple decades go by, and people can revise it and speak rationally about it. But the Holocaust, totally different thing. The propaganda was hot and heavy enough during the war, and then after the war, every decade, it just got hotter and heavier. Until, number one, you get the term Holocaust is invented, is created, and then you get the laws in Germany and Canada and France first. Those were the first three, and then other countries after that. You get the laws that criminalize revisionism, and all of a sudden you're stuck with something that should have been revised so many decades ago. This whole thing could have been very gently revised back in the 70s. But by that point, it was too important to certain special interest groups. And they were going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that common sense would not prevail in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is why I call it platinum sense, because it's pretty freaking rare.
Yeah, it's From my point of view, and knowing the people who I've known who have been punished for this, I'll give you one example for your listeners. There's a gentleman, his name is Germar Rudolph, G-E-R-M-A-R, Germar Rudolph. Now, Germar Rudolph was a doctoral candidate at the very prestigious Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart, one of the preeminent scientific institutions in the entire world. And Germar Rudolph was a young man in 1994, and he was asked by a revisionist who was on trial. Germar Rudolph was asked to conduct some chemical sample testing at Auschwitz in the supposed gas chamber rooms. Now, Germar Rudolph, he was a young man. He was married. He had a baby. He was a doctoral candidate. He was a brilliant young man with a bright future ahead of him. But he was asked to be a court-appointed witness and expert at a trial, and he agreed. He's not the man on trial. It was a revisionist who was on trial. The revisionist hired Rudolph to just do a chemical analysis. Nothing about opinion, just take some samples, take some brick and mortar samples and run a chemical analysis. Germar Rudolph did this, and he was then prosecuted. He was prosecuted for simply being a court-appointed expert in another man's trial. It gets beyond Orwellian. I honestly don't think that Orwell or Huxley or any of those futurists could have imagined that you put a guy on trial and then he asks an expert witness to do a chemical analysis, and the expert witness gets put on trial now. Guillermo Wolf ended up being sentenced to a long prison term in Germany. He fled. He went first to Spain, then to the UK, then to Mexico, and eventually made his way to the United States. The United States ended up handing him over to German authorities, even though what Guillermo Rudolph did was not a crime here. In the United States, thank heavens, we cannot criminalize Holocaust revisionism. We can only rely on thuggish private groups like the Jewish Defense League to attack people, or groups like the ADL, groups like that, the Anti-Defamation League, to attack people.
I've still got a curious, I mean, who formed those organizations and what's their actual point? I mean, are they kind of like just, the New York Mets or something, or if you're satanic, the New York Baphomets, they've got these things called cheerleaders and what have you, who just sit around and yell and dance and look pretty and what have you to distract everybody from the fact that there's copious quantities of advertising all over these people.
Well, each group is a little different. The Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, that's a very establishment, well-heeled organization. The Anti-Defamation League has been around for a long time. They get a lot of money. They like to present themselves as a respectable, quote-unquote, civil rights organization. They have no problem with bullying, harassing, and lobbying with their money to get their way. The Jewish Defense League was a slightly different animal. The Jewish Defense League was initially formed by a man named Rabbi Meir Kahana. Rabbi Kahana, to put his views in the easiest way to describe it, Rabbi Kahana was pretty much in favor of just kicking every Arab and Muslim out of any territory that Israel wanted to expand to. Rabbi Kahana really did not like Arabs and Muslims. He despised them. He was killed in the early 90s. He was shot in the head, and a guy named Irv Rubin took over the group. Irv Rubin had been Rabbi Kahana's protege over the decades. Irv Rubin was a glorified thug who enjoyed pipe bombs and punching people, including me. However, and this might maybe come across as a little odd to your listeners, Vinny, but in all the years that I dealt with Irv Rubin threatening me, beating me up, there was something honest about him, because he never claimed to be more than a thug. I'm not in favor of thugs. I'm not in favor of hoodlums and vigilantes and people who are violent. But at the same time, he never had pretenses. He was the kind of guy, he didn't like you, he'd break your nose. He didn't like you, he'd come and punch you. I think I'm a little easier with that than I am with the people who pretend to be something respectable, like the Anti-Defamation League, where they pretend to be some respectable civil rights organization, and they're not. I'd probably be happier with the thug. Maybe it's because I went to an inner city Los Angeles high school that was primarily gang controlled, you know, street gangs. Give me a thug, I can deal with that. It's the pretentious people, the ones who are thugs at heart but claim to be something better. Those are the people I have more of a problem with.
Yeah. It reminds me of the Sound of Music. You know, you were 16, going on 17, but it's more like you're just a wussy piece of crap who can't even be bothered knowing who it is you are and what reality is, because you're too afraid that it will destroy your entire life. And trust me, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know an iota of what reality currently is and you want to find out, it will destroy your life. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes about it. Oh, here's everything I spent my entire life trying to understand, and now it's fracked. Yeah. You know, that's basically the decision, and why so few people actually really want to listen to this kind of thing, because it's inherently traumatic in and of itself to let go of things. So when people hear reality and it doesn't compute, it doesn't line up with their perception of reality, they'll have a grieving process. One of the stages of grieving is anger, like beating somebody up for no reason.
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's been hard for me because I lost many friends in the early 90s. And then a year ago when I was outed, my gosh, I lost a lot of friends. Of course, I don't think they were ever really truly friends because of how they abandoned me. But they did not want to listen. And what made it frustrating for me is these were people, some of the political friends I had, these were people who trusted me and knew me to be a sane, rational individual. These were people who published my work on their blogs, on their websites, in their newspapers, and they knew me to be a man who is not prone to going off the deep end and saying crazy things. So when I was outed, and when everyone got to know that I was David Cole instead of David Stein, the percentage of my friends who said, well, you seem to be a smart guy, let me at least listen to your point of view, that's like 2%. 98% didn't want to hear it, didn't want to even entertain that I might have been speaking the truth.
Do you know what percentage of the U.S. population fought against the British and beat them?
No, I don't know the number.
2%.
Really? Interesting. I did not know that. And that's very interesting, Vinny. I didn't know that.
It shows how many people are actually prone to, A1, have revolutionary thought, and B2, actually act on it.
Yeah. That's a very, very, very good point. That really is. Because the majority of the people who I was friends with up until a year ago, they just marched in lockstep with the path of least resistance. And I was given the option of recanting. I was given the option by the Republican Party of just recanting my views on Auschwitz and the Holocaust and the gas chamber. And they were like, well, you won't be the guy that you were, that you can salvage some of it. And that's a choice that's not a choice. I'm not going to do that. I'm not about to lie and say things I know aren't true in order to salvage a little bit of friendship and approval by people who obviously weren't even my friends to begin with. So I just couldn't. I couldn't recant. That's why I decided to write the book and be as balls out as possible in terms of explaining what I was always saying for the last 22 years.
Yeah. See, me, I only think it's justifiable to lie to liars like cops and politicians, for example.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree with your policy on cannabis, officer. And no, I'm not smoking a joint. This is a cigarette.
When you're in a corrupt system, you lose respect for it. And it's very difficult to respect the people who are the officials in a corrupt system.
And it's even harder when they've got no respect for you or the truth.
Yeah, yeah. So I just decided at that point a year ago that to hell with it. I'm going to write a book and be completely honest and out there about everything. One of the things to go back to something I already said about how wonderful my publisher is, but one of the things that I loved about my publisher is that they did not put any limit on how revisionist my book can be. In other words, they didn't say, oh, don't say that. That's going too far. I was given absolutely no limits. When people read my book, that's my thoughts, with no censorship and a little bit of cussing. There are a few four-letter words in the book, but that's kind of who I am, and so it's a very honest, straightforward book.
Well, David, I was meant to take several breaks and what have you, but you just keep going, which is good.
Yeah, I'm a little verbose. I'm certainly not the
kind of person.
Could
you define the word verbose specifically for me?
Garrulous, talkative, and not knowing when the hell to just shut the hell up.
You know, there's something to be said for that, though, because technically this is talk radio, and that's kind of what you're supposed to do.
I'm one of those guys who has never had a problem with public speaking. I love it. I love being able to just talk in a public setting. It's fun for me, and I did it as a revisionist, and then I did it during my political years. It's something that I really do enjoy.
Hey, and now with the internet, you could probably start your own radio show, bro. It'd be great. You could rant, talk over the guests. It'd be fantastic.
Oh, I'm doing video blogs, which is funny to me because my ex-girlfriend used to do video blogs, and I always thought that was the kind of thing that, like, young girls do when they want to show makeup tips. And now, all of a sudden, I'm doing video blogs explaining various things and showing video clips to support my work. I feel young again, 'cause I'm 45, and I've never quite felt my age. But I'm not sure if it's a good thing. I think I'm not sure how much of my voice people can take. I have a very unique voice, and to me it's kind of an annoying voice, so I hope your listeners were not overly annoyed by having to listen to me for this long.
Don't worry, man. There's plenty of irritating voices out there, and you know, you're actually probably on the lower end of the scale. I've heard worse.
But you know, you've got that great New Zealand accent, which I kind of rank up alongside of the Irish accent. It's great accents that people love. Me, I kind of sound a little bit like a rock quarry crumbling, you know, like just a bunch of gravelly bits of dirt falling on themselves. I don't necessarily think I have a good voice. However, if people do go to my website, biginfidel.com, they will see a link to my YouTube video logs where they will not only get a chance to hear me being verbose and garrulous, but they can see me as well, which is just icing on the cake, because it's even worse to have to see me along with having to hear me.
You know, I think you just spared a whole lot of people a lot of heartbreak.
I just hope that the book that I've written will speak for me, because I did put a great deal of effort into it, and I really do think that it can go a long way towards bringing some common sense to this issue and the way that the Holocaust has been abused politically, Holocaust history, how it's been hijacked politically, how stuff's been invented for political reasons. If I can, in my own little way, now that I've been thrown back into this, and I'm older, a bit wiser, still just as talkative and annoying, but older and wiser. If in my own little way, if I can bring a little bit back of common sense to the field, I really hope that it'll all be worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, like I always say, ladies and gentlemen, the best thing you can do is just not nothing. You know? that's what we get. How can I contribute? How can I do this? Well, sitting there just talking about how you can do it as a start, but you actually got to start doing something, anything. Just don't do nothing.
Very well put, my friend. Very well put. I would agree with that 100%.
David Stein, ladies and gentlemen, you can check out his website. Again, that is biginfidel.com. biginfidel.com. not to be confused with the MILF porno website, biginfidelity.com.
I should have gotten that. I should have gotten that domain name when I could. That would have been even better.
Yeah, you might have had some increased traffic there with erections. Now, thank you very much. We will see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Please remember this is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you can, please do go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. Thank you very much. We'll see you again.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.